This episode is brought to you by Cart Driver, Denver's home for wood-fired pizzas, fresh oysters, seasonal market plates, cocktails, and conversation.
Hi, this is Jenny Goodman.
And I'm Alex McCreary.
And we are the hosts of Opening Soon on Heritage Radio Network. We listen to HRN and are actually guests on several shows before bringing our own show to this network. And it's been so amazing to see and hear the unparalleled content that comes from our community, even with limited financial resources. HRN's been making food radio for 10 years. HRN staff and hosts make it look really easy, but making the best food radio out there is actually really hard work.
We're super excited to be a part of Heritage Radio Network, and we invite you to join us in making sure that in our second decade, HRN is stronger than ever. So become a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate right now. You can even show your support by selecting Opening Soon in the designation drop-down menu. Thanks for listening to HRN.
Welcome to Why Food. This is Valerie Lomas here. This is a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers. And today we have Anna Goss. She is the author of Heirloom Kitchen. Anna, thanks for coming.
You forgot to introduce your co-host, Valerie.
Oh my goodness!
This is Valerie's first time doing the intro, so I won't take it personally.
Okay. And so Ethan, our lovely co-host, can you introduce yourself, please?
I'm Ethan Fridge. I'm Valerie's co-host.
Welcome, Anna. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
To get started, I actually shared something with you, Ethan, last week. Some red dragon fruit. Did you have a chance to try them?
You know, I took it. I had a meeting with a restaurant that we supply called Van Da, a Vietnamese restaurant in East Village, and I gave them both of the dragon fruits.
Oh my goodness!
Because they do a cocktail. They have this amazing cocktail on the bar with a dragon fruit. A pink dragon fruit simple syrup as part of the cocktail is beautiful. It's this amazing pink color. And I showed up for the meeting to show them some stuff that I had gotten from Vietnam, some spices. And I pulled the dragon fruits out of my backpack and the chef was like, are you using those? So I wound up, they wound up on the bar at the restaurant.
I'm happy that someone gifted them to me and I could give them to you.
And I handed them off to somebody else.
And they did not hatch into dragons.
Unfortunately.
Okay, so we're here with Anna, who is such an amazing woman. And she has had such an amazing career leading up to this launch of her cookbook that happened this April. So Anna, it would be awesome if you could just tell us a little bit about how you got started in the food industry.
All right. So it's not a, you know, direct path, but I think it was a fun path. So I went to university. I went to NYU. And my objective at that point was to get, you know, a liberal arts degree, which I did. I ended up majoring in psychology. I loved it. And I graduated actually in 3 years with a psych degree. So when I graduated, I realized I really wanted to stay in Manhattan. And, you know, when you're not a student, it's really not that inexpensive to live in Manhattan. So I got to a point where I said, all right, how am I going to stay in the city while I kind of figure out the next step of my life? So I went to Career Services and they said, look, you know, I know you have a degree in psychology. Not really much you can do with that. But right now it's very in vogue for corporations to come to us looking for liberal arts majors. So if you're willing to take some interviews, maybe you can get a good paying job doing something in business. So I said, sure, why not? So I did end up taking a job with an insurance company and it was interesting and it was fun and it paid enough to keep me in Manhattan, which is what I wanted. So we went that route. I did that. I loved it. I actually did very well at the job, got promoted, you know, kind of worked my way up the corporate ladder, and everything was working out very well. I got married. You know, time passes. I got married. I had two kids, and we decided to move to the burbs because your admission ticket to Manhattan gets more and more expensive once you start having kids. So we ended up moving out to Connecticut, and I got to a point in my life after my second daughter was born where I said, you know what, I'm really just not happy. And I think that's basically what happens with career changers, right? You're in a job, and everything is kind of going along. You're in that hamster wheel. You're moving. And then something just kind of clicks or snaps or whatever it might be where you say, you know what, maybe this isn't what I want to do with the rest of my life.
Was that like an internal, like, realization, or was there like an event, like was it the actual birth of your daughter, maybe being on maternity leave where you had time off and I don't know, were you cooking and feeling happy and content, or what was that?
That's an interesting question, because I think when I look at the moment, I didn't realize it. But yeah, looking back in retrospect, I think it was, you know, first of all, when you have kids, your priorities change. And, you know, you start juggling. It's that life balance, life career balance that, you know, and men have it too, but definitely as women, we feel it of, okay, I have these small children. I have to go to work. When I'm leaving my kids, you know, am I creating something? Am I fruitful when I'm not with them, that it makes sense to be leaving them? And I didn't have that feeling anymore. So I kind of took a break. You know, I just quit my job and I was like, okay, I'm going to stay at home with my kids and I'm going to kind of sort this all out. And, you know, while I'm doing this, you know, I'm watching Food Network and I'm reading Gourmet Magazine and I'm doing all the things that I've been doing since I was a kid, which is enjoy food. And, you know, I was on the phone with my dad one day, kind of having, you know, a quarter life crisis. And he said, you know, you really like food. Why don't you look into culinary school? And it was like, wow, that's not a bad idea. Maybe I could do that.
Did you feel like you had permission before to go to culinary school? I feel like it's kind of like, you know, when you're on a more like traditional, you know, education trajectory, like majoring in psychology or liberal arts, right. It's like, you know, you wonder like where that would fit in.
Exactly. And I mean, I think you really hit on something there, because you're right. You don't, when you're looking at your job, you know, I mean, I always gave, so I went to NYU, right? So they're huge acting school. And I marveled at these people. I would look at them like almost like, you know, I was like at the zoo looking at the, you know, because it's like, wow, you have decided to go to school to be an actor. Like, you have zero guarantee of anything. No job security, no money, nothing. I'm sorry to all the actors out there. But it's a huge risk, right? And I always just found that so fascinating, because I'm just not built that way. You know, I was always like the planner. You know, I think I mentioned before, like, I'm your type A, 5-year plan, have it written down. So you know what? You're probably right. It wasn't even something that really even came into my mind. I was on that very traditional, you know, get into a good school, get a great job, get paid well.
Right. And you did all of that. So
check. Yes. So yeah, I was checking the boxes, but sometimes when you're checking the boxes, you're just not happy.
No.
You're just checking the boxes.
Right. So your dad was like, maybe go to culinary school, and you had a moment and you did it.
Where do you think he got that idea from? Was your father the cook growing up, or?
No, my dad is a college professor.
Okay.
But I think when you're a college professor, you're also very analytical. And if he was analyzing my life, how it was, or how our family kind of was, it was, you know, we love food. My mother is an Italian immigrant. She always cooked for us. You know, I did not grow up on, you know, boxed foods or processed foods. I grew up on her cooking. It was every night my mother cooked for us. And so food is such a big part of our life. We always joke, like, we're one of those families, like, at breakfast, you're planning what you're eating for lunch. And then at lunch, you're discussing what you might have for dinner. And then at dinner, you're really talking about, but what are we going to eat the rest of the week? That's kind of us. So, yeah, our lives revolved around food. And Food Network also really became big when I was kind of in those formative years. So it's so funny, because some people, like older people, will be like, you know, I watched Julia and Jacques. It's like, I watched Rachel Ray, like 30-minute meals. I loved it. You know, 30-minute meals. She had a dinner on the table. It was fascinating to me. And especially when I graduated from college, like, I'd come home, literally watch her show, and then make the meal. And I was like,
It's amazing. Magical. It's like.
It is. Cooking is magical. And you feel such a sense of accomplishment when you make something. So, yes. So I did it. I took the leap, right? Left everything I knew behind at a very supportive family, very supportive husband, went to French Culinary Institute. Now it's called ICC at night, 3 nights a week. And it was crazy. I look back like, how did I do it? But I think when you're passionate about something and you kind of like realize what you want in life, like maybe those people that want to be actors, you just do it.
And was it a little challenging? Because obviously you were probably in school with people who were a little bit younger, who were maybe kind of like ripe and ready for that, you know, that line cook lifestyle and everything that comes with it. Whereas, you know, you're a mother, you've got kids, you live in Connecticut.
Yeah.
So how did you manage to kind of like balance that part of the culinary lifestyle with whatever it is that you wanted?
Yeah. Your questions are so good, by the way. And that is so true, because I was in the room with a whole bunch of 18-year-olds. But I was also, I wasn't the oldest person in the room. There were a couple of career changers, but like older career changers. But yeah, we were kind of like a melting pot of people. But yeah, there were definitely some people that did not go to college and were going straight to culinary school, and they wanted to end up, you know, at Jean Georges, at Danielle. They wanted to end up on a line. And I walked in and was like, yeah, I'm not working a line. I got two babies at home. I need to make something else. And again, going back to the fact that I always pored over food magazines and Food Network and all that other stuff going on, I walked into Career Services. And again, I can't say enough about Career Services. They've always been my backbone of everything I've done, and said, look, I am 30 years old. I have two little babies at home. And I'm here and I'm loving it. But I want to work in food media. How do I get there? And they're like, okay, this is what you want to do. We'll find out how to get you there. And
they came through for you.
They came through. I mean, within a couple of months, they said, Martha Stewart Living is looking for an intern in the test kitchen. Would you be willing to do it? It's during the day. I was going to culinary school at night. I was like, all right, let me see if I can make this work.
I love that, because it's also like, because you were a little bit older and you were a career changer, you knew what you wanted. Not only did you know what you want, you went and you told other people that, you know, they could kind of help make that happen.
Yes.
And you got in the test kitchen at Martha Stewart Living. That's huge.
Yes. I mean, and I think there's something to be said about being older and knowing exactly what you want and having the confidence to just say it, which you don't have sometimes when you're younger. So
I'm just co-signing on that.
Yeah.
Was there something about food media that you found appealing? How did you know that that was what you wanted to work
because in? I was so immersed in it. Okay. You know, I mean, it's so funny. Like, all I really needed was Food Network. I remember when Cooking Channel came up, I was one of those geeks calling my service provider and being like, when are we going to get Cooking Channel? My sister lives in the city. She's got Cooking Channel. I want Cooking Channel. They're like, who are you? Like, just pay your bill. But no, I mean, I was so immersed. And then, I mean, I still subscribe to Bone App, Fine Cook. I mean, you think of a food magazine, Savour, it comes to my house. It's just, it's what I live and breathe. And somebody's out there creating that, and I wanted to be a part of that. So I ended up working at Martha Stewart, and it was amazing. I mean, it's everything you would think it would be and more, because they run that place like, I don't know, I would liken it to like a surgical suite, like with doctors. Everything is pristine. Everything is exact. Everything is measured. You're not just going to recipe test. You're going to recipe test. This is going to come out.
What's the difference? Can you kind of like walk us through that?
Yes, because I think somebody can scribble something on a piece of paper and give it to you, and you can try it, and it might work and it might not. Mm. And people do that with cookbooks too. You know, just roll the dice. That's not how it is there. You know, if it's going to be in the magazine, if it's going to be online, it needs to work. So what I used to always joke with people, if you make a Martha recipe and it doesn't work, it's you, it's not her. You missed a step, you got distracted, you substituted with something that wasn't going to work, because the recipes are pristine. And I loved the science of it. And it's just silly stuff. Like, for example, one day we were making, I think we're making like a coffee cake, and I had to measure sour cream. So I said to Monita, who is the test kitchen kind of manager at the time, I said, do you measure sour cream in a liquid measure or in a dry measure? Because it's kind of a liquid, but it's kind of a solid. So, but like, just the fact that I was asking that question, because it's so exact, you don't want to do it wrong. So I just learned so much there.
What was the answer?
Dry. She does it in a dry.
This is why I weigh things.
Yes.
They weigh the same.
And you're a baker. So you know, but as Americans, right. everything online is cups. And but no, you're right. Weighing is obviously the most exact.
I would not have known that sour cream is measured in it.
Yeah, well, that's because you're a true blue baker. yeah, so it was just little things like that that kind of got my mind working that way, and I loved the science of it. So then from there, I went to Food 52. But Food 52 was not the huge megalo monster that it is now. It was, you know, it was small then. And I grew up with that company, and I loved what they were doing because it was home cooks, four home cooks. And, yeah, culinary school hooked me up with very, very great job opportunities. So I was home with my girls, and I was recipe testing from home. I was writing articles. I was freelancing and just loving life, loving what I did.
And now you have a cookbook. So, and you have a very specific concept, a cookbook really that I haven't seen anywhere else. And one of the reasons why we were so excited to have you on the show was to talk about that. So there was a, tell us the story. Tell us the,
I know.
So, I mean, so obviously, you know, you've done all of this recipe testing mm-hmm. and your mother is a great cook of Italian food.
Right.
So surely you knew how to make those recipes, right?
No.
That was a perfect serve. Yes. That was nicely done.
Yes, that was a very soft serve.
Yeah.
No, I did not. Because if you have an Italian mom or an immigrant mom, you may be in the same situation as me, that they get a pot, they throw a whole bunch of stuff in, everything comes out perfect, but nobody knows what they did. And you don't need to know, because anytime you want your mom's meatballs, you simply have to call your mom. And she'll drop whatever she's doing. Because, you know, you want meatballs, or my kids want rice balls, or my kids want, you know, one of her pasta dishes, because Nani's always ready to make those. So about 5 years ago, I said, wow, I don't know how to make my mom's meatballs. This is embarrassing. I should know how to do this. And more importantly, these are important to my family. It sounds so kind of silly, but if you think about your family recipes, like, what's more important than that? If you think about your family heirlooms, like maybe your mom's, you know, engagement ring or some picture on the wall, but what you're really going to miss when your mom is no longer with you is that big dish of whatever she used to serve you, because it's a big dish of, you know, her love, right? So we got in the kitchen, my mother and I, and we started getting all the recipes down. We started with meatballs. We went through everything. I create this family cookbook for my sister, myself, everybody. We all know how to make mom stuff now.
And then what a special gift to give everyone.
Well, yeah. I mean, and I have a son now, but I had two girls at the time. Although my son is quite the little chef himself.
I bet.
But my sister has two girls, and, you know, it's just, we all love my mom's cooking, and to just be able to know that these recipes are around is special, and it's important. So then I had my Oprah aha moment, as we talk about. Oprah, if you're out there, I love you. I thought, okay, I have all these friends. I went to NYU. My wedding, my dad said it. It was like the United Nations. Like, all my friends are from everywhere. I have this beautiful mix of different ethnicities, cultures, traditions. So I needed to put out a service to my friends, and I was going to get a blog out of it. So I wrote an email and I said, all right, you have a mom from someplace else. I know she's cooking for you on Sunday and you don't know how to make anything. So how about I come to her house? She shows me how to cook all this stuff. I'm going to give you a standardized recipe. And in return, I get to learn how to make your mom's dishes. And she gets to go up on my website for a day, be famous. And I thought a couple people would respond, but no, it was like wildfire. Everyone's like signing up their moms. Nobody was even getting permission. I was just showing up. But all these women were really into it. And what I love is at the time, it was really just an idea. It was just a blog. Like, hey, mom, my friend's going to come over. She wants to know how you make bulgogi. And the mom's like, okay, I'll go to the store. I'll get the stuff. Let's do it. When I got there and I'm talking to these women who so remind me of my mom, even though they're from other places, the sentiment, the feeling, it's all the same. I started asking, why did you come to this country? And all these beautiful immigration stories came out. Some of them are really dynamic. Some are sad. Some are challenging. But I was like, this is just as important as the recipe. This tells the story. So I'm like jotting down the recipe. I'm jotting down the story, and I'm putting it all up on the blog. So you get to really meet this woman. And, you know, with social media, it's so great because you put it up on Facebook, right? And then their child tags it. And sometimes even the mom's on Facebook. So she tags it. So you have all these people reading. So it kind of blew up and it was fun. And then all it took was someone saying, you know, Anna, you work on all these cookbooks. Like, this is a great cookbook idea. So then, you know, I was like, got my mindset on that. Like, yeah, I want all these women in a cookbook. And yeah, so 2 years ago, I was able to strike a deal with HarperCollins. And now Heirloom Kitchen is out in the world to buy. And it's almost 40 women, all the women I cooked with. They're now in the book. And their pictures, ephemera from their life, their stories, and their recipes. So it's a little bit of everything.
Tell us a little more about the process of walking into somebody's kitchen and cooking with them. There must have been so many different styles and techniques and aesthetics of food, but also like what was it like to enter somebody's life in such an intimate way?
What's strange is how similar the experience was every single kitchen I walked into, right? First of all, I was always greeted with warmth and acceptance and also such humility, like, me? You want to cook with me? What can I do? You know, this is nothing. So I loved that. I did feel like I was standing next to my mom most of the time, just the way, you know, they move around the kitchen and the accent and, you know, just the love, you really feel it. Every kitchen I went into, they wanted me there because I think on some level, they really admired the fact that I cared. And that's, you know, our moms were not posting on Instagram or worrying about likes and followers or whatever. They were cooking because that was their job.
Right.
We needed to eat. You know, my mom didn't, I think we ordered pizza like once a month. Like, I'm not even joking. Like, my mom cooked every single night. And it wasn't in vogue or sexy or in fashion. It was just what had to be done. So now the fact that someone was like, and then you do that. Wow, that's amazing. That's a cool technique. Where did you learn that? Oh, my grandmother. So just the fact that somebody was paying attention to them in that way, I think they really were drawn to that. I'm also incredibly personable and nice.
How do you feel like those recipes had changed? What form were you were looking at a version of that recipe that had been in certain ways adapted for mm-hmm. the ingredients that were accessible, the mm-hmm. equipment that was available in a kitchen in the United States. So, I mean, to what extent and more specifically, how did you feel like those recipes might have changed from the quote unquote original version mm-hmm. that the women you documented had cooked at home?
Yeah. I mean, then we get into the big A word, right? Authentic.
Oh, it's such a minefield. Yeah.
I know. I try not to step on any bombs. So, yes, everyone will say, you know, this is authentic. That's not authentic. I think that, like, authentic should be just, like, striked out of the dictionary because I think even if you go, let's say you go to Italy, right, and you go to two restaurants next door to each other, their meatballs are going to taste different. Is one more authentic than the other? So I try not to even touch that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, people came here. They had to adapt. They didn't have Amazon. They didn't have spices from Vietnam being brought in. They didn't have you eat.
No burlap and burlap and barrel yet. No,
exactly.
The next generation.
We're not there yet.
We'll hook them up.
Right. So they did have to make do. So most of them, it was very close to what their mother did. But I think everyone kind of adds their own flavor once they get in the kitchen, they get right. comfortable. The one nice thing is, I made this joke, no one like brought a sous vide machine over from the old country. So there was no worry about not having the right equipment. Like I think I say this in my intro, like I found America at the bottom of a mixing bowl because literally most of these recipes, it's a mixing bowl and a wooden spoon. And a lot of them yeah. did bring the wooden spoon over from the old country. Like that was in the suitcase. So because of that, they didn't have to really mess with too much. But yeah, I mean, I think everyone does something a little bit differently. Like, it's so funny. The woman that showed me how to make pierogies, she's like, sometimes I put ricotta cheese and spinach in them because they taste really good. but don't tell my mom. Like, I mean, her mom that's still in Poland.
Right. I love that because, I mean, back to that, like, that tricky A word, authenticity. I think it's all about context, right? And that's the beautiful thing about your book is you're not just presenting, you know, these recipes from these women and how they've adapted in America and, you know, carry this bit of culture with them. You're telling their story.
Right.
So, I mean, food where culture is the context kind of like puts things into perspective. And I think that's just another beautiful thing about like what you've given not only to your family, but these other families is this idea that like food is culture. Right. So to understand a recipe, you need to understand like where this recipe came from and the whole story behind it, even the wooden spoon or other, you know, right. other parts of it. So I love that, you know, your book really honors and profiles the women behind the recipes and just tells a bigger story about what a recipe is.
Right. I mean, I think also a well-crafted story can encourage empathy, inclusivity. It does that. And also, trying food from someplace else, right? I mean, I've never been to Thailand, but I love Thai food. And I remember when I was in college and I tried it for the first time, I was like, wow, this is really good. And then I wanted to learn about Thailand and about like lemongrass and like things that I had never tasted as a kid. So I think sometimes like you can like trick people into liking you if they like your food.
Yeah. And you were mentioning that a little earlier, right? When you were going into the kitchens and the homes of these women, like a kitchen is a very intimate place. It's like people don't even necessarily want someone
in their kitchen
or like helping wash the dishes or fine china.
No one let me wash dishes. No one. These women, like I would pick up a spoon. They'd be like, no, like I could not help anyone. But yeah, no, it is. And especially for immigrant women. I'm also like this too. Like, get out of my kitchen.
Right.
This is my space. Get out of my kitchen. So yeah, letting you in. And then when you're in there, because they've let you in and they're in, their inhibitions do release. And that's, I think, why the stories came out. And it was funny too, because sometimes when I was editing the stories, because I sent the stories back to everybody because I didn't want to write anything that's... And so I'm like, yeah, you can leave that little part out. Like,
was it the best part?
Yeah. Not always. Sometimes it was just something that might have been a little personal or a story that maybe they didn't want the whole world to know. But that's why I say that this book is a celebration because of course, you know, you can get political about anything. You can get political about vanilla ice cream. I said, I could have read a book about vanilla ice cream and someone would say, why don't you include chocolate? So you could look at my book and get very angry or political about, okay, well, you know, what are you trying to say here? And I'm not really trying to say anything other than whatever you believe, unless you're, I don't know, blind, this is a country of immigrants. This is a country of all kinds of different people. And I think for the most part, we really celebrate it, whether you realize it or not. Because when you're walking around Brooklyn or, you know, anywhere, not even if you go to remote areas of the country that you wouldn't expect, you can have food from somewhere else. You can't say they're not everywhere in the world. You go to most places in the world, they're eating their food. Here you eat everybody's food. And the reason that you're eating everybody's food is because people came here and continue to cook their own food. They continue to celebrate their own culture. And we all kind of got on board. So it's the book's a celebration.
I think one of the tricky things is that there's this idea that recipes from other parts of the world in the United States are sort of written for white people, right? Written for mainstream, quote-unquote, American cooks. And, right, there's a pretty specific image that conjures
Right, they're,
up.
Like, afraid of fish sauce.
Yeah,
and, like,
exactly.
Those types of ingredients.
Well, so I guess two questions. One, have the women that you profiled, have they cooked each other's recipes? And what were their experiences doing that?
Mm-hmm.
But then also, I mean, how did you, or maybe you didn't, adapt those recipes for kind of more mainstream white American
palates?
And just
accessibility also.
Yeah, sure.
So, all right, accessibility wasn't an issue because, again, these women have been cooking here for 50 years or 40 years. So, yes, there are a few recipes that the women will get specific things that are not, like, easy to get. But 99% of the ingredients in this book, and I can tell you because I recipe tested this book many times, you can get at your local grocery store because that's where these women cook. So that's one. Number two, the American, or you could say the white palate. These women were cooking for their families. These aren't restaurant recipes. And I did not adapt the recipes. That was actually what I did not want to do, because I wanted Nelly's spanakopita to taste like Nelly's spanakopita. I wanted the goulash to taste like Anki's goulash. That was the whole point of the project. You know, anybody can go online and find a recipe for German goulash, but when her kids made it, I wanted it to taste like their mom's, just like I wanted the meatballs to taste like mine. So I didn't adapt it. So when you're talking about adapting for restaurant eating, or for, let's say, you know, the white palate, did that happen? Probably, like you said, fish sauce or whatever. But again, we're going back to authenticity, and I think that's okay as long as we're respecting the fact that it is different, but you're still getting, like when you spoke to the woman from the Museum of Food and Drink, I loved that interview because she was just talking about all these different levels, right? So when you go out to eat Chinese food and you eat mugu gai pan, I don't think that they're eating that in China. Maybe they are now, but a lot of these recipes were adapted for Americans. But didn't they still get their point across? Didn't they still show us their techniques and their flavors and get you into their restaurants so that they could feed their families? And we got to maybe not a full authentic slice, but we got a slice of who they are. So I think that's okay.
I think I get what you're saying. That's a really great point. I just also want to say, like, fish sauce is indeed delicious.
It is indeed delicious. And like the women in this book would have absolutely used fish sauce in their homes because they're cooking for their kids. So
right. I love that. They're cooking for their families.
So there was no adaptations, and I didn't adapt. And I think now we're also living in a world where, like, my kids have had fish sauce. I did not have fish sauce at 5 and 6 years old. It's funny, the woman that I cooked with from Lebanon, she's like, when we got here from Lebanon, we had to switch pita bread for Wonder Bread. Mm. You couldn't buy pita bread. She's like, so we started eating Wonder Bread. She's like, hummus? We had to make it. Now you can get it in 50 flavors. You can get chocolate hummus, for God's sakes. But she's right. But I think that's great. I think it's great that my kids can go into a Middle Eastern restaurant and my daughter knows what to order and she knows what she likes. And how great is that? That she knows a tiny little slice of Middle Eastern living by eating their food. And the Middle Eastern patrons that are in the restaurant also eating, you know, the man, for example, that might be from Syria or Iran that's cooking the food that you get to meet when you go to the register. This is all interacting and good stuff. So did he alter the recipe of the gyro maybe? I don't know. But at the end of the day, if everyone's walking out happy and understanding a little bit more about each other, isn't that the point?
Yeah.
Am I going to get in big trouble today?
No, let's let's take a quick break. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Cart Driver, Denver's home for wood-fired pizzas, fresh oysters, seasonal market plates, cocktails, and conversation. Tucked in a 640-square-foot shipping container space in the heart of Denver's Rhino neighborhood, Cart Driver is the perfect place to stop in for an Italian-style spritz, Prosecco on tap, and a wide variety of tinned fish. Open for lunch, dinner, community hour, and late nights 7 days a week, Cart Driver is here for you with fresh, domestically sourced ingredients, and above all, hospitality. Learn more at cart-driver.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. It's Todd Shulkin, the host of Inside Julia's Kitchen here on HRN. Inside Julia's Kitchen carries on Julia Child's legacy of introducing the brightest lights in the food world to a wider audience, just as Julia did from her home kitchen. Look for Inside Julia's Kitchen wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back. Valerie's posting on Instagram during the break. Awesome. Follow us on Instagram, Why Food Podcast. We're here this week with Anna Gass, who is the author of Heirloom Kitchen. Before the break, we were talking around and through some of the questions of authenticity that invariably come up. And I wanted to hear more about how the women that you've profiled in the book have interacted with each other. Have they cooked each other's recipes? What do they think?
Yeah, so that's really fun. So when we launched the book, I ended up having a huge book launch party and invited all the women. And so they did get to meet. And that's a lot of them. That's the first time they got to actually go through the book and see it. So that was magical, watching them open the book, see their picture, everyone happy. And then what was really cool was, like, for example, one of the Greek women was like, she's like, kibbeh, this Lebanese dish, we make this in Greece. I'm from Cyprus and we have a dish just like this. But we do this, we do that, but it's the same dish. And then, you know, the Egyptian woman also looking at the Greek recipes and saying, pastitsio, we make this, we just call it this or that. So it's funny because you see how arbitrary borders really are, because everyone's really making the same variation of different foods. And I always say, like, every culture has a dumpling. Like, think about it. Ravioli, pierogies, Chinese. Like, if you think of wherever you're from, somebody in your family at some point took some dough, put something inside it, and either boiled or fried it. So we all kind of making the same stuff with just different, you know, different twists on it. So yeah, and then I do love it because, for example, the Armenian woman, her daughter now makes the spanikopita for like every Thanksgiving. Like, that's like her go-to recipe. So yeah, we've definitely had some mingling within the book. And again, just watching everybody at the book launch meet each other, talk, open up the book, see how it all ended up was very heartwarming. I'm very lucky, you know, that I was able to write a book absolutely for myself, but also for these women. It's a unique experience, but it's also very rewarding. And they're also doing a good job promoting and selling my book.
Well, so actually that's a perfect segue. This is a podcast about career changers. And so we like to talk about ways that skills that you picked up in your first career has transferred over to your second or your new one. You had a career in corporate sales.
Yeah.
And now you found yourself with a product to sell. What were some of the lessons that you learned, the skills that you've transferred, the parallels between what you're doing now, the way that you're marketing your book, and the way that you sold insurance?
Well, the funny thing about when you have a book, or even when you just announce that you have a book deal, everybody comes up to you with their book project idea. Like, hey, I have this great idea for a book. And they're like pitching me. Like, I have any say in like their book. So I'm here to say writing a book is not easy. And writing a book, I mean, I can only speak to cookbooks. I haven't written a novel. But writing a cookbook, and I think a novel too, it's a whole bunch of little jobs within one big job. So first it's, you could call it like product development. What's my point of view? What do I have to say? And how is it unique? Because nobody's going to buy your book idea if it's just another book about mac and cheese. You know, like, you need to have a strong point of view, something that people are going to grab onto. And I felt that I had that here. It was something unique. I love it when people say, I've never seen a book like yours. Well, I did my job. I put something out there in the world that's new and different. So that's it. That's the first thing. So first you have to sell that idea to a book agent, which I obviously did successfully. So that book agent has to now believe in you, and you have to create a platform. Because as much as you might think a book sells itself, it does not. Walk into any Barnes & Noble or any bookstore, there's a whole bunch of books. So how are you going to make yours stand out? Well, that's you. You're going to make your book stand out. You could write the best book in the world. If you drop that book on the pub date and you go hang out, it's not going to sell. You need to be out there promoting. So that's like a whole nother part of the job. And then there's also the nitty-gritty of writing the book. So the recipe testing, the cooking, the understanding. And my book had other layers because I had contributors involved and I was testing other people's recipes. But even if you're doing your own, I don't care if you've made your, you know, banana cream pie 50 times. If you're going to print it in a cookbook, you better make sure that you're making it the same way every time and that it works. Because in this day and age, when I can go online and search banana cream pie and 500 things are going to come up, if I'm going to buy your book and I'm going to invest $20, $30 in you then I, in return, what I expect is a recipe that works.
Can we just maybe go one step back? Because you mentioned platform building. Mm. And you have a really wonderful Instagram account. It's beautiful and quite a, you know, hefty social media following. Mm-hmm. So is that a part of your building your platform? And did that also play a role in you being able to get a book deal?
It did. I don't know that you can get a book deal in today's age. And I could be wrong. If you don't have some sort of presence in today's social media society. I know there's people that have done it and probably doing it successful. That was not my course. When I went to my book agent and she loved the idea, she's like, you really need to kind of build yourself up more. And I was like, so are you saying you love the book, but maybe I need some work? And she's like, well, I go, no, that's okay. Because the book idea I can't change, but me, I can change. I can become something better and bigger. So that's what I did. You know, I really worked on content. And it was funny. I got some really good advice from someone. She said, you should look at your Instagram like it's your personal magazine. It's what you're putting out in the world, how you're representing yourself to every single person in the world that doesn't know you. So what are you putting out into the world for people to understand who you are? And again, your point of view. Your point of view is very important. So that's what I did. It was quality content, posting a lot. I'm not going to lie. It's a job. If you want a successful Instagram account, and let's face it, whether you love it or hate it, it's the bar now. It's the bar nowadays. You're like laughing, but I think...
Yeah, you're right.
No one wants to say this stuff out loud. Right. And maybe people will be like... Ugh.
And it's work. It is work. Even if you love it. Even if you love, you know, posting on social media and, you know, every little like and comment gives you a little like thrill or some satisfaction.
I mean, I think that's what it is for my 12-year-old daughter. you know, she goes in her room and she takes a cute selfie and she posts it and... you know, 20 of her friends like it. And hey, that's fantastic.
Right.
For me, and I think for anyone that's looking at Instagram the way I think many adults do, it's a part of your job. It's a part of your job. It's not something that I do willy-nilly. If I'm posting a picture, I do want it to look presentable. I do want it to look nice. I want people to follow me because when they follow me, again, they're learning who I am. You know, it's not about the slice of pizza I just had. It's about what was I doing when I had that slice of pizza, or, you know, did I meet the owner, or what how did they create it? So yeah, that's part of it. And then there's the whole editing process, which nobody warns you about. What? I got to edit this book like 20 times over? That appealed to me though, because I'm such a stickler for accuracy. But yeah, I mean, your book goes back and forth and is transformed 5 and 6 times. And I worked with HarperCollins. It's the only publisher I know. But they were pristine. It was, you know, every comment, every punctuation, every explanation had to be perfect. And I mean, there were 5 or 6 editors on the book, someone just looking at recipes, someone just looking at the women's stories, my personal editor who was combing through. Then you get the book laid out and it's like, okay, does it make sense to have this picture here? Does this recipe need a demo? Do we need to show the dumplings being made? Yes, I think we should have that. So, you know, then you get your photographer. Like I say, somebody should write a book on writing a book.
Right.
How collaborative was that process? How much input did you have? What were the compromises that you made?
Very little. I had a very strong point of view, and I felt that my editor heard me. And if there was something, like for example... I didn't know what I wanted the picture on the inside of the book to be. Like, this is how nitty gritty it gets, right? Like literally every page. And she's like, well, I think we should have the picture of Tina wrapping the dumpling because, again, going back to like, it could be anybody's grandmother making anything right there. She could be making a pierogi. She could be. So it's a universal shot and it sets the tone for the book. And it's like, yes, I like that. But then we had another page that I didn't like the way the old pictures were melding with the new pictures. I was like, you know, this picture, this page just looks really muddy to me. It looks confusing. And she's like, what if we did this? And it was collaborative, but I had a very strong point of view and a voice. And I always backed up my opinions with my thought process. And the answers were, most of the time, they were yes. I was very adamant about the cover of the book being my mom's hands. And it was probably like the only time that I was like, oh my God, I got to call my editor and I got to put my foot down.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, the cover's beautiful. I was going to ask about it. I guessed that it was your mother.
It is my mother, and it's her cutting the hand-cut pasta, which is called tagliatelle. And it's, you know, the picture has a lot of meaning for me because my grandmother cut the pasta that way. She taught my mom. I remember going to Italy, watching my grandmother cook the pasta. That photo has a lot of layers of meaning for me. So what happened was I made no comments about the cover. And everyone I talked to in the industry was like, the one thing you won't have say on, Anna, is the cover. It goes to committee. There is, yes, a committee that discusses your cover. They will look at all the pictures taken from the book. They will decide, you know, all the heads will nod. An agreement will be made, and you're just not going to have anything to say. So I kind of like resolved myself to that. But then I got an email from my editor. These are the four pictures the cover committee is considering. And one of them was my mom. And I was in an airport, and I was like pacing this airport like, no, it's got to be that picture. And I was on the phone with my photographer, and I was like, okay, you know, you're not, and this is Andrew Scrivani from The Times, who's wildly talented, and just buy the book for his photography because it's beautiful. But I'm like, what do you think? And he's like, it's got to be your mom. And I was like, okay, then it's got to be my mom. And he's like, well, this is what you should say. And I kind of listened, but I was like, all right, how am I going to do this? And I got off the phone and I called my editor, and I, you know, you don't call anybody anymore. It's always like a conference call. It's scheduled. You don't ever just phone bomb someone anymore. Like, that's the past. But I was just so, and she's like, hello. I was like, Christina, it's Anna. And I got your email. And she's like, uh-huh. And I was like, so I just, and by this point we had boarded the plane, and I'm crouched over in my seat, 'cause like, I don't want to bother any of the other, you know, like the dinging is going off and they're telling you to put your seatbelt on. It's like, so I just really want to talk to you about this cover. And like, I couldn't wait. Like, I couldn't have waited till I landed. Like, I had, and I was like, so I just really feel like it needs to be my mom's hands. I was like, I can sell this cover. This cover means so much to me. And I would just really like the cover committee to consider this to be the cover and not really even look at the other ones. And we can reshoot it and make it more perfect, but this needs to be the cover. And she has since told me, she's like, Anna, that's like one of my favorite conversations of all time. Because you so know what you wanted, but you didn't want to like just like ram it at me. But we both knew by the end of the conversation that was going to be the cover. So, but that's the collaborative process. And I got very lucky that I was working with people that were willing to listen to me. So I just felt blessed all the way around.
What's next for you? What is this a loaded question?
This is a very loaded question because everybody asks it, and it's a natural question, right? The answer is I don't know.
That's an awesome answer.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a very uncomfortable answer for me, but I'm incredibly proud of this book. I feel like it's a culmination of my life. My life is on every page, like we talked about. My sales, my cooking, my mother, my life as a child of an immigrant. It's all on the pages of this book. So I really am presenting myself to the world. I'm very proud to promote it. I feel very comfortable talking about it. And I am waiting for the universe to open up the sky and send down a tablet with what I'm going to do next, because I think that's going to happen and it's going to be natural, and we'll see where it goes.
Where can our listeners find your book, pick up a copy, maybe meet you at an upcoming event or a book talk that you're giving?
So I am going to be going down to Baltimore, actually. I'm going to be doing an event down there. It's called Bird in Hand with the Slow Food Org. You can actually go to my website, see all my events. AnnasHeirloomKitchen.com. You can follow me on Instagram at Anna F. Goss. So it's A-N-N-A, F as in Frank, G-A-S-S. That's my Instagram. Check it out. Know that I put so much work in all of my photos. that's where you find me. I'm easy to find.
Do we have time for a couple rapid fire questions, Ethan?
Amanda, do we have time for a couple of rapid fire questions? She's making
equivocal face. That's like a yes, no.
That's a yes. Go for it. All right, we're gonna
favorite recipe in the book, really quick.
Yeah.
My mama's meatballs.
Love it.
Favorite kitchen utensil.
Wooden spoon.
Awesome.
a skill that you, if you could master a skill overnight, what would it be?
ice skating.
Oh, wow. All right. Cool.
I can't do it.
All right. Well, Anna, thank you so much for joining us. This has been so much fun to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
I just got a copy of the book, so I'm really looking forward to playing around with it, trying to make some of the recipes.
Great.
As always, you can reach us via our Instagram, Why Food Podcast, which Valerie is in charge of. So if you want to get in touch with Valerie, DM us on Instagram. No. yeah.
Yes, we love to hear from you. Yes, so we love to hear from comment.
You. You can email us at whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org. You can follow me personally via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, or Burlap and Barrel on Instagram.
And you can follow me also on Instagram at Foodie in New York.
Thanks to Amanda, our awesome sound engineer, and our theme song, which is Blind by the Red Crickets. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter. Our handle is @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.